This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This looks like a lot of books, but do not fear. There's a time limit to what we are going to do tonight. Start with a few brief things. Where is it now? Here is a box for you. A large box labeled box. Open it and you will find a box in it labeled box from a box labeled box. Look into it, I mean this box now, not the other one, and you will find a box labeled, and so on. And if you go on like this, you will find, after infinite efforts, an infinitely small box with a label so tiny that the lettering, as it were, dissolves before your eyes. It is a box existing only in your imagination, a perfectly empty box. This is an identity check. This is not Dante. This is a photograph of Dante. This is a film showing an actor who pretends to be Dante. This is a film with Dante in the role of Dante. This is a man who dreams of Dante. This is a man called Dante who is not Dante. This is a man who apes Dante. This is a man who passes himself off as Dante. This is a man who dreams that he is Dante. This is a man who is the very spit image of Dante. This is a wax figure of Dante. This is a changeling, a double, an identical twin. This is a man who believes he is Dante. This is a man everybody except Dante believes to be Dante. This is a man everybody believes to be Dante, only he himself does not fall for it. This is a man nobody believes to be Dante, except Dante. This is Dante. Well, here's something out of a faraway period called the 60s. Let's see, where is it? Ah, yes. Well, it's called, perhaps I first read it in German for a change, Lied von denen, auf die alles zutrifft und die alles schon wissen. Dass etwas getan werden muss, und zwar sofort, das wissen wir schon. Dass es aber noch zu früh ist, um etwas zu tun, dass es aber zu spät ist, um noch etwas zu tun, das wissen wir schon. Und dass es uns gut geht und dass es so weitergeht und dass es keinen Zweck hat, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir schuld sind und dass wir nichts dafür können, dass wir schuld sind. Und dass wir daran schuld sind, dass wir nichts dafür können und dass es uns reicht, das wissen wir schon. Und dass es vielleicht besser wäre, die Fresse zu halten. Und dass wir die Fresse nicht halten werden, das wissen wir schon, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir niemand helfen können und dass uns niemand helfen kann, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir begabt sind und dass wir die Wahl haben zwischen nichts und wieder nichts. Und dass wir dieses Problem gründlich analysieren müssen und dass wir 2 Stück Zucker in den Tee tun, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir gegen die Unterdrückung sind und dass die Zigaretten teurer werden, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir es jedes Mal kommen sehen und dass wir jedes Mal Recht behalten werden und dass daraus nichts folgt, das wissen wir schon. Und dass das alles wahr ist, das wissen wir schon. Und dass das alles gelogen ist, das wissen wir schon. Und dass das alles ist, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir es überstehen, das wissen wir schon. Und dass das alles nicht neu ist. Und dass das Leben schön ist, das wissen wir schon. Das wissen wir schon, das wissen wir schon. Und dass wir das schon wissen, das wissen wir schon. Well, in English, it's called song for those who know. Something must be done right away. That much we know. But of course it's too soon to act. But of course it's too late in the day. Oh, we know. We know that we are really rather well off, and that we'll go on like this, and that it's not much use anyway. Oh, we know. We know that we are to blame, and that it's not our fault if we are to blame, and that we are to blame for the fact that it's not our fault, and that we are fed up with it. Oh, we know. And that maybe it would be a good idea to keep our mouths shut. And that we won't keep our mouths shut all the same. Oh, we know, we know. And we also know that we can't help anybody really. And that nobody really can help us. Oh, we know. And that we are extremely gifted and brilliant and free to choose between nothing and naught. And that we must analyze this problem very carefully. And that we take two lumps of sugar in our tea, oh, we know. We know all about oppression, and that we are very much against it, and that cigarettes have gone up again. Oh, we know. We know very well that the nation is heading for real trouble, and that our forecasts have usually been dead right, and that they are not of any use, and that all this is just talk. Oh, we know that it's just not good enough to live things down, and that we are going to live them down all the same. Oh, we know that there is nothing new in all this, and that life is wonderful, and that's all there is to it. Oh, we know all this perfectly well, and that we know all this perfectly well. Oh, we know that too. Oh, we know it. Oh, we know. Now, there's some more recent stuff here. Let's see. The tin plate. About poverty, all has been said that it's tenacious, sticky, persistent, and of no interest to anybody save the poor. It is boring. It has too much to worry about to complain about boredom. Like dirt, it is to be found weighed down. It's contagious, smelly, a nuisance. Its omnipresence is striking. It seems to partake of eternity, attributes which are divine. Helpers and saints seek it. Monks and nuns are betrothed to it. With the rest of us all our lives on the run, poverty catches up at the next street corner, unmoving, unmoved, majestic, tin plate in hand. Well, should we do another one in German, perhaps, and see where I can find it? It's sort of here. No, I can't find it. Nice Sunday. The old whiskered gentleman, frail of fame, frail of frame. Look at him sitting there on his little bench in front of the shelter, in front of his very own shelter. Look at him sitting there, knitting, muttering in the morning sun. What did he say? What did he say? Nice Sunday today. Nice Sunday today. Now we'll drop his knitting gear, sniffing the air. He will cock his ear. He will watch out for someone coming up to bash in his head. Look, he picks up his needles again, humming to himself. Nobody there. Nobody there. Nice Sunday today. Well, for a change, this is called an optimistic message. Here it is. Optimistic little poem. Now and then it happens that somebody shouts for help and somebody else jumps in at once and absolutely free of charge. Here in the thick of the grossest capitalism, round the corner comes the shining fire brigade and extinguishes. Or suddenly there's silver in the beggar's hat. Mornings the streets are full of people hurrying here and there without daggers in their hands, quite equally after milk or radishes, as though in time of deepest peace. A splendid sight. What about the German? Ah, yes, I do something. Look here. No sé cuánta gente hay en esa ciudad que habla español, pero como un pequeño homenaje a la situación bilingüe de la ciudad, voy a leer un pequeño texto en español. Un día negro. En tales jueves se corta el dedo incluso el más experimentado carnicero. Todos los trenes tienen retraso. ¿Por qué las suicidas no pueden contenerse? El ordenador central del Pentágono hace tiempo que se ha descalabrado y todos los intentos de reanimación en los baños públicos llegan tarde. Para colmo, al lado, en casa de Marotkes, se sale la leche. El perro tiene dolores digestivos y ni siquiera la tía Olga, la inquebrantable, está en su mejor forma. In English, this would give, let's see, a black day. It's a black day. On Thursdays like this one, even the most experienced butcher chops his finger off. All the trains are late because the suicidal have finally let go. The central computer in the Pentagon crashes early on, and at the swimming baths, efforts at resuscitation come all too late. And if that weren't enough, next door at Mrs. Marotka's, now the milk is boiling over. The dog has something wrong with its digestion, and not even Auntie Olga, the indestructible, is quite tip-top. lighter than air. Poem games do not weigh all that much. As long as the tennis ball is climbing, it is, I believe, lighter than air. Helium, for sure. Inspiration, that tickling in the brain. Also, St. Elmo's fire and natural numbers. They weigh nearly nothing. And less still, their posh cousins, the transcendental numbers, even though innumerable numbers exist. So far as I know, that is also true of the field around a magnet which we cannot see, for most hollows and for all the dunes and waltzes without exception, lighter than air, like forgotten grief and the bluish smoke of the definitely last cigarette is, of course, the first person. And as far as I know, the scent of burnt offerings pleasing to the gods always rises toward the heavens, as does the zeppelin. Much, in any case, hangs in the balance. Least of all weighs perhaps what remains of us when we are under the ground. What else? Well, there's this thing. I have a thing about these ballads, these biographies. Keeping track of a person's life in a very short space, just a few sentences, really, in the form of a ballad. I think it's very economical. You see, poetry has one of the advantages of poetry that is most of it is short. You can say a lot in a very small space. And this is one of these biographies about an American, one of the greatest mathematicians of the past century, John von Neumann, lived between 1903 and 1957. It's German and Spanish again. What a mess. Here we are. I must say the translations are due to Michael Hamburger, to Reinhold Grimm, to David Constantine, and a few of them I did myself. John von Neumann. Moon face, double chin, waddling gait, a stand-up comedian, most likely, or a salesman for fitted carpets, a bon vivant from the Rotary Club. But as soon as he starts to think, watch out for Janci from Budapest, the soft processor under his skull cap will relentlessly tick away, and with a mere flicker of his memory chip, he will produce a rush of ballistic equations. In three moves, he checkmated Eichmann and Stalin. Göttingen, Cherbourg, Cherbourg, New York, New York, Princeton, always first class. He escaped from the final solution. All he needs is 4 hours sleep, plenty of whipped cream on his Viennese strudel, and a couple of Zurich bank accounts. Even those who have never heard of him, and most of us haven't, switch with a click of the mouse into his algebraic circuitry. Without his own brand of it, artificial intelligence might never have got off the ground. Whether it's a question of playing dice or detailing a hurricane, you name it, self-fertilizing automata or firing tables, the piece of chalk in his hand will lag behind the speed of his mind. A maniac, scribbling down Hilbert spaces, rings, and ideals, operating beyond all limits with unlimited operators. A few new ideas, he says, and we could make the planet dance. An elderly wunderkind with an interface to the CIA. Helicopters roaring down on his lawn. Fat man on Nagasaki. Pure mathematics. War is his cocaine. There is no such thing as too big a weapon. Always in high spirits, lunching with admirals. A shy fellow at heart. Some mysteries his black box cannot cope with. Love, for example. Stupidity. Boredom. Pessimism, a sin against science. Energy out of the can. Climate control. Eternal growth. To turn Iceland into a tropical paradise, no problem. The rest is nebby. Finally, staff outing to another island in business suit and blackened glasses. Bikini. Operation Turning Point. The test was successful. The cancer from radiation took 10 years to turn off his synapses. Well, we have some more time, apparently. You give me a signal. Well, and then I've gone with something called The Reprieve. I think it's called The Reprieve. That's another optimistic one, you know. The Reprieve. Watching the famous eruption of a volcano on Hæme, Iceland, which was broadcast live by any number of TV teams, I saw an elderly man in braces, showered by sulfur and brimstone, ignoring the storm, the heat, the video cables, the ash, and the spectators, including myself, crouching on my carpet in front of the livid screen, who held a garden hose, slender, but clearly visible, aimed at the roaring lava, until neighbors joined him, soldiers, children, firemen, pointing more and more hoses at the advancing fiery lava and turning it into a towering wall, higher and higher of lava, hard, cold and wet, the color of ash, and thus postponing, not forever perhaps, but for the time being at least, the decline of Western civilization, which is why the people of Hæme, unless they have died since, continue to dwell, unmolested by cameras, in their dapper white wooden houses, calmly watering in the afternoon the lettuce in their gardens, which, thanks to the blackened soil, has grown simply enormous, and for the time being, at least, fails to show any signs of impending disaster. Well, what else do we have here? Ah, yes, for Karajan and others. This kiosk, do we have that in German? No. No. All right. Three men in stiff hats in front of Kiev main station, trombone, accordion, saxophone, in the vapors of an October night that hesitates between two trains, between disaster and disaster. They play for tired people who very devoutly bite into their warm piroshki and wait, wait. Heart-rending tunes, worn like the jackets and greasy as their hats. And if you had stood there chilled among alcoholics, veterans, pickpockets, you would have agreed with me. Salzburg, Bayreuth and La Scala don't compare all that favorably with the main station of Kiev. An encounter of the other kind. The reasons for the massacre must be looked for in the 13th century. That's what I read this morning at breakfast. That bees are not deaf, but hear with their antennae, was made known in Sanford, California. Neckties are now worn a little wider. This was proved to me by a junk mail missive from 33102 Paderborn. Time is not a parameter, but an operator, my friend the philosopher confided to me. Information learned on a single Tuesday. I recited it to the neighbor's cat. Her flame-colored striations gleamed in the sun. She kept her eyes fixed on me. I sensed that her fur was electrically charged. It was evident that she recognized me. And yet, she lived in a universe other than mine. So it seemed to me. She mooed. But what she knew about matter, about space and time, she did not reveal. One metaphysic grazed the other when I shared my kipper with her. Our decisions, hers and mine, so it seemed to me, were reciprocally unfathomable as those of the gods. Further reason why poets do not tell the truth. How about that one? 123. Weitere Gründe dafür, dass die Dichter lügen. Weil der Augenblick, in dem das Wort glücklich ausgesprochen wird, niemals der glückliche Augenblick ist. Weil der Verdurstende seinen Durst nicht über die Lippen bringt. Weil im Mund der Arbeiterklasse das Wort Arbeiterklasse nicht vorkommt. Weil wer verzweifelt, nicht Lust hat zu sagen, ich bin ein Verzweifelnder. Weil der Orgasmus und das Wort Orgasmus nicht miteinander vereinbar sind. Weil der Sterbende, statt zu behaupten, ich sterbe jetzt, nur ein mattes Geräusch vernehmen lässt, das wir nicht verstehen. Weil es die Lebenden sind, die den Toten in den Ohren liegen mit ihren Schreckensnachrichten. Weil die Wörter zu spät kommen oder zu früh. Weil es also ein anderer ist. Immer ein anderer, der da redet. Und weil der, von dem da die Rede ist, schweigt. Further reasons why poets do not tell the truth. Because the moment when the word happy is pronounced never is the moment of happiness. Because the thirsty man does not give mouth to his thirst. Because proletariat is a word which will not pass the lips of the proletariat. Because he who despairs does not feel like saying, I'm desperate. Because orgasm and the word orgasm are worlds apart. Because the dying man, far from proclaiming, "I die," only utters a faint rattle which we fail to comprehend. Because it is the living who batter the ears of the dead with their atrocities. Because words come always too late or too soon. Because it is someone else, always someone else, who does the talking. And because he who is being talked about keeps his silence. About the short history of the bourgeoisie. This was the moment when, without noticing it, for 5 minutes, we were vastly rich, magnificent and electric, air-conditioned in July, or, in case it was November, the flown-in Finnish wood blazed in Tudor fireplaces. Funny, it was all there, just flew in by itself, as it were. Elegant we were. No one could bear us. We threw solo concerts around, chips, orchids in cellophane, clouds that said, "I." Unique. Flights everywhere, even our size went on credit cards. Like sailors, we banded curses. Each one had his own misfortune under the seat, like a seatbelt ready to grab at it. A waste, really. It was so practical. Water flowed out of taps, just like that. Remember? Simply stunned by our tiny emotions, we ate little. If only we would have guessed that all this would pass in 5 minutes, the roast beef Wellington would have tasted different, quite different. What do we have here? A fumble. Ah, yes, the great goddess. That's not bad. The great goddess. The great goddess. She works away day and night, bent over her darning egg, an end of thread between her lips, mending all manner of things. Ever new holes, new ladders. Sometimes she nods off just for a moment or for a century. Then, pulling herself together, she's back at her needlework. How tiny she has become. Tiny, wrinkled, and blind. With her thimble, she feels for the holes in the world and dance and dance. Well, it won't work. Yes, I'm not an autobiographical writer, but sometimes the biography creeps in. This is about my grandfather. My grandfather, happy man, never got far in thinking about life. He parted with appetite, wore natty hats, and frequently thought he was in the right. At 97, incredulous, and for the first time, he saw the inside of a hospital. "Pity," he murmured. "If only I'd known how charming the young nurses are around my bed, how gentle their hands. Sooner, much sooner, I'd have fallen ill." He pulled a face, turned his eyes to the bell, and died. No more. Okay. Unpolitical preferences. That little smile on the cellist's face after her cadenza in the second movement, even though the Security Council has just convened. The deep seriousness with which the woman there puts on her makeup in the ruins of her kitchen dining room, even though around the government buildings there is still gunfire. That man and wife, octogenarians, rowing about cat hairs in the bed, even though the peace negotiations have reached a decisive phase. The howls of grief because the maid has smashed the Jubilee mug, even though the Monetary Fund at that very moment has refused credit support. And behind the barn, the lovers, breathless and beside themselves with eagerness,
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, this is very pleasant. I've heard you read before, and there's always a feeling great pleasure on the part of the audience. I mean, they laugh, they respond in a way that is not common in poetry readings. They seem to be enjoying themselves completely. Why do you think is that?
Actually, I don't really aim at that. It comes by itself, more or less, and because, perhaps it has to do with the German tradition. The German tradition is rather the opposite, and so you work against it, and I mean you try to when you are very serious, especially when you are very serious, you try to cover it a little bit, cover yourself, and mm-hmm. don't appear as the man who is trying to be deep, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
Must be some mechanism of the sort which makes you a little bit rebel against the givens of the situation.
I was also struck, I mean, how much the subject of so many of the poems is sort of human comedy. I remember Nicanor Parra, the Chilean poet, once defining human beings as a sausage of angel and beast. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that sort of definition, mm-hmm. that aspect, I mean, many of the characters who appear in your poems have some of this quality. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm very fond of tragicomedy.
Right.
Because, I mean, to be a really good comedy always has a black side, a black reverse to mm-hmm. it, mm-hmm. and the other way around, of course.
Right.
I mean, the greatest of them all, look at Shakespeare. I mean, it's always something funny, even in the worst of situations, there's always something there. And it's just because, and especially in our type of society we live in,
I mean, I think it would be very pretentious to claim that we are tragic figures. We are more involuntary. This involuntary comedy, which does not cancel out the depression and the misery and so on, but it is always there. So when we listen to ourselves complaining, for example,
right.
I mean,
you have a lot of poems about somebody complaining. But when you started out, how did you see yourself when you started out? I mentioned, what was astonishing to me about your early poems is their accessibility. I mean, they were so clear. Sometimes, being understood is the most difficult thing in the world.
I'm not quite sure, because there is also a certain superstition on the part of many people who think they need a professor to approach a poem,
right,
to have it explained somehow.
Right.
I mean, that is also something, in fact, very often the interpretation comes between you and the text, so you should first try to connect, just to look at it. And it's also not necessary, to really understand each little nuance, each little trick. people are perfectly capable of guessing.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a word, a strange word in a text, I hop over the word and I try to guess what it would mean. So. It's a question of how to approach things, and I think, in that sense, I'm unacademic.
Who were your models? When you
well, started? I owe quite a debt to the poetry of Brecht, because Brecht had not so much ideologically, but he had a knack, a sort of onion structure in the poem. So by that. Everybody could get at a first layer of meaning there. It looked very simple. It looks very simple. Everybody knows. There's no old aunt who could claim, "I don't understand it." She could understand it. But then the more you became interested in things, you took off one layer, and there was the next layer, and there was another layer with allusions and all sorts of tricks, which poets have a lot. We have plenty of tricks, of course. But even without knowing all the tricks, you could somehow get at what he wants to say. And so that is something I think Brecht was a model in that respect.
What about the reception in Germany of the poems, like the first book?
This kind of a sort of relaxed stance which I now seem to. Mm-hmm. Project was rather hard won, because, after the war, you can imagine. You were not very relaxed. It was a terrible situation in every respect. I don't want to enlarge on it, but your feelings were, you had very strong feelings of indignation, of rage even.
Mm-hmm.
Rage, and so there's something shrill about my early poetry, which I think was not so much only due to my temperament,
mm-hmm.
but to the situation. You just felt that you had to do this to clean up a bit the place and the language and so on. So
a kind of a corrective almost.
Yes, and then to the extent that the situation is not as a matter of life and death as it was then, so you could. Sort of
because there was always a parallel tradition of avant-garde, extremely avant-garde poetry. You never had much use for the avant-garde. You have written many very critical essays of the sort of aspirations of the avant-garde.
I have great respect and even admiration for what I would call the historic avant-garde of 1910 and 1920, and all these people. I mean, they were due to the situation. I mean, you had just to do away with a lot of stuffy things, of this mess, of accumulated mess. I mean, when they said they wanted to blow up the museums, I mean, that was given 1910, this very stuffy atmosphere in Europe, the academic painting and all this lot of things, you know. So there was a need for that. They had a real agenda. They were, in a certain sense, desperate. It came out of a necessity. Yeah. But the replay of the avant-garde, I mean, after the Second World War, it became a subject for the seminars. I mean, people learned how to be avant-garde in the university. And so, I mean...
One of the interesting things in this essay, I mean, I'm going to quote you here. You say, the farther removed they are from any sort of experience, the more the experiments of the avant-garde are experimental, you said. The empirical self is of no interest to them. I mean, you seem to me to be the poet for whom the empirical self is of great interest.
Yes, I mean, that is true about the better part of literature.
Yeah.
It is based, of course, on human experience.
I mean, Sappho was interested.
It became a kind of... like a chess game, you know, an abstraction, of course. It became an abstraction.
Yeah.
And then the replay, however, became more and more thinner. It became threadbare, I would say, especially in literature. I mean, you would have to, of course, you would have to qualify a little bit if you think about the painting and about, you know, I wouldn't be rash enough to throw everything in the dustbin. That's not what I mean. But in literature, given also the social nature of the medium you work with, because, I mean, paint is not bodily yours.
Sure,
it's substance here. But, I mean, language is a social thing. Nobody owns language. You can't. It's arrogance also to say language is what I determine to be. So the letterists and all these guys, you know, who make up their own languages, it doesn't carry you very far. That's all.
I agree with you completely, but the inevitable question, I mean, next question would be, how do you feel about the poetry of someone like Paul Celan, the later poetry?
But he, first of all, I mean, his whole poetry, of course, is based in a very strong kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
you can't understand anything of it if you're not aware of that.
Right.
So the experience is there. It is hermetic in many respects, and I cannot claim that I understand everything he says.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. There are things which and it's not by accident that there are now two critical editions of his work with commentary, which is about five times as much as the text, because there are many private allusions which without any help you actually cannot decipher. So there is a limit to what this first approach, the first level of the onion.
Of the onion, right.
You see, that, sometimes I get that, but I can't claim to have got to the center of it all, which would presuppose that the Hasidic tradition in Jewish life, what the rabbi said there in the 18th century, and because it's all full of illusions. So, and if you don't, but he was a great wordsmith. He was very creative. I mean, I knew him, and I always had great respect for him. But it is also not necessary that I have some very famous poetry which I don't quite understand. And I don't hesitate. I think we all ought to admit that we have limits of our understanding. Why not? There are certain texts of Hölderlin, who is one of the great German poets. I say, Look indeed. Correct. Not everything, but some of them. Why not?
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, I teach, you know, I mean, Hart Crane, I mentioned, for instance. I mean, there are poems of Hart Crane that I at times have understood and even managed to lecture on them for an hour and a half.
Crane, yes.
Years went by, and I looked at them again, and I understood nothing. Anymore.
Forgotten the,
and then maybe another 10 years.
Maybe they will.
And some
return.
People, you know, come.
Yes. Or Ezra Pound. I mean, notorious. Without a key, you need a key.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, Finnegan's Wake. I mean. Yeah.
Well. Well, speaking of language, I mean, another very obvious question is, first of all, you know, I mean, how did you learn such fine English? I mean, how early? I mean, I remember reading about you being given all these books by the American soldiers, right? American
yes, that's true,
and so
yes,
forth.
Yes.
And you were already reading when you were a teenager, you were reading American literature.
Yes. Well, I mean, when finally our regime broke down, and it was the end of the war, and finally the Americans arrived. Of course, this was really something tremendous. Fresh air came. I mean, you just get rid of all these bastards, and it was great. And then America, the United States, being in some respects a very, it has harsh sides, but there's a tender side even to the American administration, or was at that point, because they thought of their GIs, how do we feed them spiritually? So they had books printed, which were called the overseas editions. They had this shape, they were oblique books, pocket books, and they sent piles and piles to every theater of operations, to the Pacific, everywhere, all over the place. And of course, some of the GIs liked, but not all of them. So there were these crates of books standing around, and I asked the captain, could I perhaps have a look? And he said, take them all. It was great. It was a discovery. And then, of course, another thing of that time, both were after the war, you know, you couldn't get out of the place. I was a young man, in young person in Germany, you just couldn't get out of the damn place. The only way to get out of the damn place was to put on a uniform and march to Paris, you know. And fortunately, I was too young for that. So. And then, of course, there was an immense need to get out. My first travel abroad was to England, and I had a long bout of Anglomania, and that helped me from the point of view of language. I had some English in school. I had a decent English teacher. Even in Nazi times, there were some decent people. And that helped me to after the war, because I immediately got a job as an interpreter for the occupation.
I remember reading one of the books among the GI books was an anthology of American poetry by
Untermeyer. Louis
Untermeyer, right? Yes. And had you read before you read that book? You knew some German poetry. I mean, you had read.
Yes, of course.
Poetry.
Yes.
I mean, who was the poet, American poet, you know, from those early days, I mean, that you sort of felt, oh, this is somebody really
interesting? Well, I mean, of course, when you are sort of 16-ish, Walt Whitman is bound to make an impression on you, because that is a kind of thing which didn't exist in Europe. I mean, not this at the same time, it was perhaps not the one which I felt most deeply about, but I was very fond of Auden. Mm-hmm. Auden was, there was this Auden of the 30s, you know.
Yes, there's a little touch of Brecht there, too.
Yes, yes. and Yates, some of Yates, yes, yeah. And then I went back, of course, in the old, yeah. The old writers, the old poets, because I don't, you know, I don't. Modernity is fine, but it's relative. I mean. People have been going on doing this for thousands of years, and some of the old stuff is just as good.
As modern, yeah.
Or better. I mean, the fact is that, of course, most of the best poets happen to be dead.
Yeah.
Statistically speaking.
when it came to translating your own poems to English, like any translator, you must have been continually reminded of the differences between two mm-hmm. languages, English, and it's clear that you understand what the advantages of English are. I mean, the way you use it in translation. But I mean, how would you describe just these differences between what German can do and what American English specifically can do? What parts of your poems you kind of had to give up on or sacrifice or simplify, paraphrase, could not translate, and that sort of thing.
That's very true. But of course, you are in a peculiar position if you translate yourself, because who is there to say that's wrong? Because in a certain sense, you create another original. I mean, you could claim that because.
Do you take? Are you a free translator? I mean,
it begins with things like, for example, if there's in a poem, there's something about the military, mm-hmm. and then of course German military tradition is not like English or American military tradition. So even if you translate into British English, there would be certain inflections or details or words which would fit the British. But not the American, mm-hmm. Not to mention the German. Yeah. So you would have to a command. I mean, it all sounds different. So it's a transposition. You try to keep as close as possible to the text, but there are things. It's not only it's a linguistic thing and it's a cultural thing. Mm-hmm. You could distinguish the two, and I think the most important thing, one of the things which are neglected by the teachers of literature, by the professors of literature, is the tone of voice, the inflection.
Sure.
And because this is difficult to categorize, there's no possible scheme to rationalize it. You can't rationalize it. But I think that's very important in translation
Once you pick up the right tone.
Yes, if you find a voice, the voice you need, then you can overcome even grammatical problems. And I mean, German has of course this almost Latin habit of long sentences. That's a difference. And then it also, when you have to do with metric verse, then things become very complicated because German has more syllables, quite simply. Mm-hmm. I mean, in English, there are verbs.
Yeah.
You don't have the conjugation, you flex, don't have the... which in other languages you have this conjugation or flexion or whatever it's called.
Do you go over the translations of that, you know, like Michael Hamburger does? I mean, do you...
When I did, I don't habitually translate myself. It's just a sort of exercise or fun or something, or being unhappy with some other translations. You try your hand, but of course it is absolutely indispensable that you have a native speaker and preferably a good poet to look at it, look it over and say this is something. Bit jarring. It's not a solecism. You could say that, but it doesn't somehow sound right. And mm-hmm. that kind of advice is very important.
Sure. Something else. You said in an essay, "I realized I had failed to discover America." we made many, many visits. This is the most recent one. And you said, how could I make up my mind about it, torn as I am between shock and gratitude, bliss and frustration, dismay and surprise? Is this still true today?
Yes, I think we ought, when we travel, we ought to admit to ourselves that there's a limit to our understanding. I mean, I'm fond of saying, for example, that America is an exotic country if you come from Europe. I'm fond of saying that. I'm insisting on that with my German friends, first of all, because they labor under the illusion that because English is spoken here and because they've seen such a lot of America on TV and have made shopping sprees in New York, that they deeply understand America, which is not true, because it will take many years. I mean, I've spent quite some time here, but still I have not come to the bottom of it. And of course, this is the obverse is equally true. But I think an American coming to France, he faces the same thing.
So French are incomprehensible.
Well, anyway, I mean, French are very peculiar. Let's face it. But so is everybody else. We ourselves are very peculiar. Everybody.
It's amazing, though, but I mean, how one still encounters, especially in journalism, there was a piece by a columnist in New York Times about a month ago who had returned to Germany after many, many years, mm-hmm. and he was in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I had to reread the paragraph over and over again because he had gone on the street the first day, and he felt that after half an hour, he had grasped Germany. And so, I mean, the sort of the humility of what you say is really pretty unusual and uncommon. Because I think, you know, it's very difficult to even say in this country that, you know, Americans really understand this country. I mean, American writers have always been very puzzled mm-hmm. with precisely what this is.
And that is also relevant in political terms because there's been a lot of debate about anti-Americanism, you know.
Sure.
And I mean, what is strange choice to be pro-American or anti-American? I mean, it's like the choice between are you an optimist or a pessimist? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course you are both.
Sure.
Bound to be. Because life is not as simple as that. And there are certain things which many people don't find extremely appealing about other places. That's simple as that. Even without going into politics. And of course, when you get into politics, I mean, politics is contradiction. So it's conflict. That's why we have to have, otherwise we could do without politics if we didn't have any conflicts.
Speaking of nationalities, here's another passage from your writing that sort of puzzled me. You said in an essay, I forget the title of the essay, on the basis of their own experience, the German people are better qualified than any other to understand what is happening in the Arab world today. Every second interview conducted from Rabat to Baghdad, this was written, I think, in 91 or,
yes.
or 89. Or
the first Cold War,
yes.
probably.
Every second interview conducted from Rabat to Baghdad must sound like an echo of their own voices. Quote, we will go marching until everything lies in ruins. The devastation of cities, the fanatic hate, the greatest battle of all time, the talk of fight to the finish or a final victory. Who can forget the frenetic cheers that answer the famous question? Do you want total war? And so forth. And I'm just curious if this still holds true, because as you know, in this country, so many people were upset with Germany for not going along with war and terrorism, war in Iraq, and
yes,
so forth.
Yes.
And,
I still think the case could have could be made for the first Gulf War, because it was a clear case of one country invading another. I mean, it was just, and of course, as a German, I felt you very strongly. I know what it means if you one day Poland is there, and the next day you liquidate a country. I mean, that is something which is not, you can't admit that sort of thing to go on. So I think there was a rationale for the first Cold War, the way it was handled. I mean, that's another matter, and so on, the consequences, that would be a long thing. But I think this rationale is absent at the present moment. Mm-hmm. It's not a replay, because now it's rather the obverse, because there's one country invading another, but in that case it's not Iraq threatening to invade Kuwait, but it's rather the United States of America threatening to invade Iraq. I mean, it's a completely different situation, and but not that my opinion would count in any. Of course not.
But the world has changed. A phrase that, or a sentence from one of your, pieces came to mind, and I was asking myself, thinking along your lines, has the amount of hate, envy, resentment, vengefulness, nastiness increased in this last decade, or is it about the same? I mean, we're under the impression that it has. I mean, not just Americans, everybody else thinks it has.
I just think that a lot of these things came to the surface, which we were in the happy condition that we could somehow ignore a lot which was going on in the world, and because we were not there, we were not in their shoes, and it of course it suited us also, because there's a limit to our empathy with people who are far away, whom we don't know anything about. So why, you can't expect people to spend day and night thinking of what is going on in Bangladesh. That's not realistic.
Sure.
So I think there was a lot going on which we failed to take seriously, at least. Perhaps there was a paragraph in the newspaper, but... and so these things have a way of breaking out. I mean, like your country, I mean, Yugoslavia looked in the 70s, it looked all right, more or less. Nobody noticed. Right. But suddenly there was this enormous energy of aggression suddenly appeared. And I think that's what we are facing, only this time we are not out of the game. We have become part of the game, and therefore we have no choice but to take notice.
True.
Yeah.
So, let me just show this.
Peep.
let me ask you, I guess we are almost finished, right?
Yes.
It must be it. That's telling us to stop. One very curious statement of yours. You said every literature is a collective effort. What does that mean? Every literature is a collective
effort. Well, that is a little bit because I have some reservations about the concept of originality. Of course, everybody who works in the arts or somewhere, there has a sort of notion, especially at the beginning, that he wants to be original. Okay, that's fine. And of course, in fact, you do something, most likely you do something which not everybody else has done before. But at the same time, you work with a capital, with a sort of capital which was accumulated by many, many people before you. And to pretend that it's all grown on your own little plot of that's not realistic, that's not true. Yeah. So originality is not the first For me, it's not my first preoccupation. Mm-hmm. To do something because nobody else has done it is not a sufficient reason for doing it.
Well, listen, thank you. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.